Twist Fridays.
I mix what I like.
My brothers and sisters, it should be more than clear to us that if we are ever going to be free, we must liberate ourselves. The courts are rigged. The whole system is rigged against our people. Despite tokenism, the fact remains that common street dogs enjoy more protection of law than black humans in racist America. If we want protection, we must protect ourselves. If we want freedom, we must fight for it. My brothers and sisters, we are now in the year of fire. This is going to be a violent and long hot summer. Prepare for it. Unite, organize, and arm for self-defense. Only a fool will turn the other cheek to racist beasts who set out to exterminate our brutally oppressed people. Human dignity requires us to fight back. In the spirit of 76, in the spirit of Watts, in the cause of justice and freedom, let our people take to the streets in fierce numbers and meet violence with violence. Let our battle cry be heard around the world. Freedom, freedom, freedom now, or death.
Man, black woman throwing water like a camel. Hillary Clinton still telling lies on the channel. Spoke at the school and thought I would have died on the panel. So the Democrats never did ride for me. They got a young and burn it down with property. Come late with my moolah, I do not take it. Jeff Rutter, you know you a motherfucking racist. Feel me now, know you just hear me now. Cause we don't want no more Bill Clinton hand me down. If they the same, I'm to blame. Say the penitentiary gon' change. The food stamps getting cut, we don't care no more. You know that man wanna treat us like an animal. With Monsanto putting poison in the cantaloupe. Streaming off the Fox News with a $1 billion bank. Give it to people for their reparations, but I can't. Shotgun in the living room if you come here. I quote, no vote, cause we revolt here. Is it wrong if I wanna get it on till I die? Hillary Clinton and Obama still telling lies. Overseas, killing Africans is never televised. It's never televised, I said it's never televised, woo! I'm black man, could you please drop your attention? Oh, you in Vegas for fight night, so what? Again, I'm a locomotive with no locomotives. As a rapper, I'ma smoke weed, then pass the blunt to the pastor. Spending out of churches, money laughing at him after. I don't believe in hell, I don't concede the life after. The greatest hustle ever invented was Christ Rapture. Them blood diamonds, you don't know, floss in here. I love shining, it ain't no love lost in here. But don't nobody put no blood on the cross in here. The black church getting bombed in this rap verse. I say the black church about to need a black hearse. Ain't they the same? I'm to blame. I'm say the white man's God could change. I reference the church as a candy store. The reverend ain't nothing but a family. Oh, do you really recognize what you starting in? Do you know that the church killed Martin? You can write me off the label, this another petty song. I crept low and never gave dollars to 80 long. Al Sharpton, I'm sorry, I know this is pitiful. With long hair, wavy, I'm get it cool. We living in the last days, the end is getting nearer. If you wanna see God, get him up on the mirror. So basically, I know I'm about to step into some deep ish. Oh shit though. Oh, the entire Democratic Party as a staff, record label, and crew.
I mix what I like. What's up, world? Welcome back to I Mix What I Like here at WPFW 89.3 FM. I'm Jared Ball. Happy to be here with you. Dr. Hate is in the building.
Hate is definitely in the building
Hate is,
this morning.
Hate is, Hate is in the building. But so is a little bit of love, a lot of love. Micey Day, Anita Ball is back in the building
hey.
As well. Man, Dr. Hate, thank you for holding us down there in the beginning. Right there was Tef Poe, his new release, highly edited new release, F Hillary. And I think that's right on time for what we want to do today and celebrate the birthdays of both Asada Shakur, which was yesterday, as was Ida B. Wells. And check out our interview with Dr. Paula Giddings up at imixwhatilike.org, paying tribute to Ida B. Wells, yesterday being her 153rd birthday. Asada Shakur's birthday was yesterday as well. We're going to pay tribute to her. And then on Monday, the 20th, is Frantz Fanon's birthday. So we want to celebrate these birthdays in the context of what's happening in the world. And as you heard already, we have Dr. Frank Wilderson on the line with us, author of Incognito, a memoir of exile and apartheid. He's one of the leading theorists of anti-blackness and Afro-pessimism. And we're also joined by the legend himself, Daruba Bin Wahad, former Black Panther Party member, former member of the Black Liberation Army. He was also a guest with me at the Real News Network, and that piece is also up at imixwhatilike.org, talking about stealth history. But we're going to have an extended conversation with the both of them right now. So welcome everybody to the show. Good morning, fellas. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So, Daruba, are you in a, is that you in the middle of a party?
Well, this is I'm not really in the middle of a party.
Oh, okay. Oh, right, right. That's right. That's right. He's celebrating
Ramadan.
Ramadan. Eid Mubarak tradition. Right. Eid Mubarak. That's right.
Is there a lot of background noise?
Yeah, there's a lot of background noise.
Okay. I'll go in outside.
Okay. We appreciate that. Dr. Wilderson, man, thank you for joining us. How are you, man? Welcome and thanks again for taking the time to join us.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm doing well. How are you doing?
As good as could be expected. As good as to be expected. But let's get right into it. We're already delayed as it is. Let's get right into it. So, Frank, we wanna jump in. And for folks who are unfamiliar, we don't want to rehash the threads that we've had on with Dr. Wilderson already. What we'd like to do is try to move this forward in the context of Fanon and recognizing Fanon's importance in today's political landscape. So, Frank, take us to Fanon's work and how you use Fanon's work to gain understanding of what's happening politically relative to black people and the attack on black people by the police. And this police state that we exist in within the U.S. and in the global scheme?
Well, I think, and that's a big question, but let me come at it impressionistically and then you can...
You know what, though? I gotta ask you guys to hold up. Daruba, if possible, can we get... We have really got to get you to a quieter spot, or we're going to have to get you to call back, or we'll have to reach back out to you, because we're unfortunately not able to hear what's going on with the celebration in the background. So if we could make that happen, we greatly appreciate it. And in the meantime, Daruba, if you wouldn't mind, just please mute your phone and as you get situated, and we'll go ahead and start off again with Frank.
Okay. Is that better now?
That's much better. But just in case, if you would just hold off and just mute your phone for a moment, and as we get situated, we would greatly appreciate it. Frank, I'm sorry, man. Please continue with your response.
Oh, okay. This is coming from me, and what I take from Fanon, what I think is important about this time period. And one of the most lasting insights that I take from Fanon is his argument with white leftists, like Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, who, and this ties directly into the police and killings today. You know, people who would say that anti-blackness is a minor term on the dialectic and that it only changes the equation of oppression slightly. And I think one of the things that I get from Fanon is some of the insights which that came through in his work, but that were too traumatizing and too big for him to follow through on in his short life to their conclusion. And one would be that the black person in the midst of all others produces a completely different equation of oppression than what Sartre and some other Marxists might think of, which is not to say, and I think I always need to say this because people sometimes accuse me of being outside of Das Kapital or outside of Marxism and suggesting that, you know, capitalism is not a problem. Capitalism is a big problem. But I think that one of the points that keep bubbling up for me in Fanon's work is that even if we were to produce a classless society, we would not necessarily have an anti-black society. And part of the reason for that is that the world oppresses other groups of people through hegemony. And when they violate the hegemony of the ruling social formations and ruling classes, then violence kicks in against white women, immigrants, post-colonial people who are not black. But one of the things that is so hard for us to get our heads around, not so much for us to get our heads around, but figure out what to do about it, is that violence kicks in for us as the first kind of oppressive mechanism. So we're ruled by a repetitive, violent policing dynamic, and other people are ruled by the constraints of the symbolic order, like the wage relation or the appropriation of their land. And when they violate or when they go against or when they resist the symbolic structures which hold in place the ideas of civil society, when other people have ideas that are contravening the ideas of the ruling class, then the ruling class puts forth its forces of violence with the police and the military to stop the spread of counter-hegemonic ideas. That's not what's happening with us. What's happening with us is that the police and violent forces are there to simply stop our movement, to repeat violence against our bodies so that we don't circulate in ways that would be threatening, like three black people on a corner, for example. And so the most painful thing for me and the hardest thing to deal with as a political person is that the world is really not interested in black ideas. The world is interested in the surveillance and containment of black bodies. And this goes back to the 1600s, at the very least, in this particular country, in which the patrol system was specifically, I mean, the genome of the patrol system was specifically to monitor and contain the movements of slaves. And in, you know, in 1686, every single white person had to go out on patrol, which is to say, like, that would be like saying today, you know, everyone in Beverly Hills would have to serve police duty. And, but by the 1700s, it was possible for people who had money to pay people who did not have money to take their place on the patrol system. And, of course, by, you know, the late 1800s and the 19th and the 20th century, we have taxes and formal policing. So if we can start to think about, I mean, I think one of the challenges is that Fanon helps us address is the fact that there can, for us, and this is specifically for black people, there can never be any policing dynamic, any sense of policing institutionality, which has the possibility for being reformed, because the police as an institution are constituted by anti-blackness. You take anti-blackness out of policing and you don't have the institution of police. And so the biggest thing for us is to transform our political rhetoric and our and the horizons of our revolutionary goals to be higher than transforming police behavior, but to be against the existence of the police themselves. Now, I'm not suggesting that tactics which move towards reforming police behavior be abandoned, because we need relief right now. But what I am suggesting is that, and I've done exercises around this in workshops for Black Lives Matter in Los Angeles and at the Audubon Ballroom, Malcolm X's the foundation now in New York, to say that, you know, we need kind of two trains running. By that I mean we have to have the kind of immediate tactical response to tactical police violence that starts to quell it. But we can't let that political response to police violence, for lack of a better word, contaminate our overall orientation towards the police. We have to be against the existence of the police, even if our tactics are such that they can't rise to that at this particular moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And just want to remind folks, by the way, that they're listening to Dr. Frank Wilderson joining us here at I Mix What I Like, WPFW 89.3 FM, at I Mix What I Like for all your relevant social media, imixwhatilike.org for more on this show and more, including a pretty extensive archive now that we've developed with Frank Wilderson and our other guest, Daruba Bin Wahad. Yeah, go ahead, man.
Frank, if you can, please delve a little bit more into this idea of surveillance and how this functions on a day-to-day reality of Black people, and how surveillance is woven into the responsibility of white society in relationship to Black people, specifically in this country, but globally. Because I get the sense that for poor whites, surveillance becomes their currency in this white supremacist, anti-Black environment.
Say, can you tweak that a little bit to say a little bit more what you're asking me?
So if I could piggyback on this, mm-hmm. Are the poor white working class cops that are likely responsible or possibly responsible for the death of Sandra Bland, mm-hmm. were they performing their function as part of this white supremacist surveillance matrix? In other words, if I understood Haight's question myself, and maybe I don't, that everyone has to participate, and he was asking you to extend your discussion of the surveillance and what it sounds like, that all whites have to participate in one form or another. So I was just trying to connect it to this most recent incident where Sandra Bland, another Black Lives Matter activist who had posted all these commentaries about police violence, is herself found dead in police custody after having been pulled over for failing to use her turn signal. Is that sort of where you were going? Hey, I don't even know if I had that.
That plus the idea of what happens to Black folks. What do they feel on a day-to-day basis under surveillance?
Yeah, well, I think this is really important, because whether you're when I first came to work here in Orange County, the head of the African American Studies program here said, he says, you're not in Berkeley anymore, so where do you keep your driver's license? And I said, well, in my wallet. And he says, no, what you got to do is you got to do a rubber band, and you got to take your driver's license and your faculty ID and put it in the sun visor of your car so that you're never reaching down around your thighs or the stick shift to get anything. You're always reaching up because they will shoot you here.
Mm.
And
welcome to California, right?
Exactly.
And we should right, what are you going to say?
Home where Reagan has set the tone.
That's right, where Reagan set the
wild,
tone.
Wild West.
And we should just get to the point where, why don't we just get we just have Black people and brown people in particular go to these car spots and get those full matte coverings of their cars in their license. You know what I mean? Like these, like, you know, you see, you know, radio station promotional truck or something, go to DTLR or whatever and get their whole car covered and be just your whole car outer, the whole outer cover of your car would be your driver's license.
I hear you.
Frank, I've done something similar.
Yeah.
I've just put a white mask on when I drive.
I hear you. But, you know, one of the things that, here's the deal. I mean, and I want to clarify this to the people who, you know, I've been called divisive in left-wing circles here, and I'm certainly not trying to be divisive. What I'm trying to do is to say to people that everybody suffers under capitalism, and a lot of people suffer under white supremacy. But all those people who suffer under capitalism and suffer under white supremacy are in some way either directly guilty or indirectly complicit in our suffering of anti-blackness. And that seems to be a very, difficult horse pill for people to swallow. But I think it's true. And the reason I think it's true is because civil society needs to know what it is. You got to know what civil society is in order to know if you're in it or outside of it. And civil society produces the inside-outside, you know, who's in and who's out, for people who are not black through the elasticity or contraction of access, so that at some point in, 1920s up to 1933, Latinos, Chicanos here were considered white. And a court case happened around school integration, and they were formalized as brown. Sikhs have been allowed to go to the Supreme Court to petition for whiteness. The fact that they lost that petition isn't really what's important. What's important is that they've been allowed to petition for that. So civil society keeps expanding and contracting with, over time, depending upon the political dynamics and the economic dynamics of the period, to produce fewer or greater players inside of its discursive capacity. But the thing that constantly remains the same, regardless of what happens to all these other groups, is that the inside-outside of civil society is always vouchsafed and understood in the collective unconscious of everybody in the world by the fact that blackness cannot ever access it. Whether you have a black president or secretary of state, it doesn't really matter. And so the reason, or how does that happen? It happens because the police function to enforce the law for all sorts of oppressed people who break various types of laws. But where black people are concerned, the police themselves make law. And this comes from something that Jared Sexton has written. The police make law on a daily basis through their violence against blacks. In other words, the question, why did the cop shoot me, is a question that has a reasonable answer only if you're not black. The cop shot me, if I'm black, because it's necessary to continue this kind of what Orlando Patterson calls naked force. It's necessary to simply repeat violent acts against black bodies to make those spectacles, because in the conscious zone of people, what people on the left and moderate people say is that, I see all these videos of Eric Garner or the man in South Carolina who was shot in the back, and that tells me that the police are doing wrong. Okay, I'm not saying that they're lying, but what I'm saying is that that's not the essential thing that's happening. The essential thing that's happening is that the repetition of visual imagery of violence against black people serves an essential function of making everybody else relieved and giving everybody else a sense of being, a sense of presence, a sense of humanity, because that kind of immediate reproduction of law made by police against blacks through killings can never happen to me. I'm going to get that kind of violence as a non-black person, they would say. Their unconscious would say, I'm going to get that kind of violence as a non-black person if I break some rules. Okay. But other black people get that kind of violence because it's necessary for the rest of the world to understand that they actually have a place and that they actually exist ontologically. And that becomes a really big thing for us to deal with as black people.
So Frank, we're gonna hold you right there. This is WPFW 89.3 FM. I mix what I like. Dr. Hate's in the building. Micey Day, Anita Ball is in the building. Daruba Bin Wahad is on the phone. He's gonna join us in just a second, because you said a minute ago, Frank, that you don't mean to be divisive, but I think there are points where we need to draw some lines, and that's something I want to bring Daruba in here in just a minute, because basically and ultimately, they don't really care about us. So don't go anywhere. Much more coming up. I mix what I like, WPFW 89.3 FM. Back in a minute. Peace.
It's Black Fist Fridays.
That's right. They don't care about us right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. I mix what I like. This is off the new Unity album, Tony Sukkar, tribute to Michael Jackson, all salsa tribute to Michael Jackson music. And as you heard right there, they did it, man. They killed it. The whole album is off the chain, man. It's off the chain. And from me personally, gave me some renewed appreciation for Mike, man. I think this crew did it. Tony Sukkar, Unity is the album, tribute to Michael Jackson, salsa tribute. And they don't care about us. And as you heard in the song, it's still unfortunately perfectly appropriate for our conversation here today, paying tribute to the birthdays of Ida B. Wells, Assata Shakur, Frantz Fanon coming up on Monday with Dr. Frank Wilderson talking about anti-blackness and Afro-pessimism. And joining us now is Daruba Ben-Wahad, a former member of the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, written a couple pieces lately, public commentaries critiquing the state of our leadership. So, Daruba, I wanted to just bring you into the conversation and let you respond to all, any or all that you've heard, and maybe offer up your thoughts in the context of Assata's birthday and Fanon's birthday and Ida B. Wells' birthday, this critique you have of the current state of our situation of leadership. Please chime in. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jarek, for having me on. Could you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Perfectly. Thank you.
Oh, the brother was right on the point, right on point, when he was talking about the genotype of white supremacy and the role that the national security state's law enforcement apparatus plays in perpetuating that genotype. But the phenotypes that we are dealing with that come with a spin off of that, the evolution of that into what we see today, is the garrison state, the military state. The United States is an empire. It has a global reach over 200 bases around the world. So we have to put in context that white supremacy's control and violence, intimidation of black folks. You know, Jarek, from in the past when we've talked, I've always maintained that the term police brutality is an incorrect term, because the police, when they brutalize and murder us and intimidate us, they're doing their job. Mm. And that's what the brother was just pointing out, that the police, from its very inception, was designed to control, intimidate, and terrorize black men with black femininity, black life. Period, and those on the left who talk about capitalism and racism being a divisive force amongst the working people, we know for a fact that historically, ever since the end of World War II, that the American working class has not been a revolutionary force for change. It's one of the most reactionary and racist working classes on the planet. But that applies also to the Western European working class. Well, that's one of the reasons why we see that immigration, especially of people of color and Muslims, is a phenomenon and a problem in all of the national security states of the West, not just the United States. It's a big problem with the EU. They're wrestling with it now. They're trying to use the North African state as a filter, as a buffer for the consequences of empire that causes people to flee their countries looking for a better life. But I don't want to stray too far away from this. This point. The point is that, as brother pointed out, reform of the criminal justice system, reform of policing is not possible. You cannot reform white supremacy. Nor is it our job as African people to reform white supremacy. What we're talking about here, what I've been talking about, and you know this very well, Jared, I've been talking about building a new abolitionist movement, a new movement to abolish policing as it currently constitutes. Now, strategically, that sounds good on, you know, in terms of rhetoric, in terms of analysis. But how do we go about doing it? And what the brother was pointing out is that he wasn't throwing reform under the bus or throwing the baby out of the bathwater. Reform was just one aspect of dealing with the immediacy of white supremacy that's killing us, you know, that's murdering us, that's incarcerating us at unprecedented rates. So reform is tactically sometimes necessary, but ultimately we have to have a revolutionary vision. We have to have we have to think sovereignly as an oppressed people, and by that I mean we have to think independently. We have to think about our own interests. And when we talk of, when the brother pointed out the institutionalization, the culturalization of anti-blackness, That means that if that is a fact, and it is a fact, and I don't think anybody rationally can argue that. If that's a fact, then it behooves us to think sovereignly as black people. If the system is skewed to maintain us in the thrall of terrorism, to intimidate us, to guide our lives so that we live on the cusp of fear every day, if that's the case, then we have to think about sovereign mechanisms within this empire that will protect us, that will empower us, and that will help our children become enjoy all of the humanity. And as the brother was pointing out, we're dealing with an ontological situation here. This is not just something that just applies to a certain group of militants or a certain class of black people. We're dealing with the ontology of life experience here in this country. And as you know, I think you mentioned the working class cop,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the brother pointed out that the significant difference is that they make the law as they kill us. They make decisions that should be left up to a court, should be left up to some type of impartial agency. They make the decision to execute us. They make the decision on the spot that you know that you're threatening. And why are you threatening? You're threatening because a 15-year-old black kid in the eyes of a white cop is like a 24-year-old man.
Mm.
You know, 11-year-old child is not a child. 11-year-old child is not a child. And so this perception comes from generations of white supremacy. And this is what I tried to point out over and over and over again, that the police, they're a generational continuation of those same Knight Riders, of the Ku Klux Klan, of the Confederate soldiers. I mean, we all know that the symbolism that was thrown at us at the end of the during the Charleston massacre, after the Charleston massacre, was a diversion. But at the same time, white folks tried to disconnect the Confederate battle flag from the history of the Confederacy.
Yeah, they did. And I think all the attention that even the so-called left has paid to the Confederate flag as opposed to the American flag has done the same thing. But let me say something to you, because unfortunately, gentlemen, we only have a couple minutes left. And so I want to ask, I found this quote. It was actually one of my favorite quotes in Frantz Fanon's the collection of essays Toward an African Revolution. I want to see if we can get Frank Wilderson and Daruba Ben-Wahad to respond to this and what I know Dr. Haight has as a sort of final concluding question. We'll have to ask you both just to be quick with it, and we'll invite people to imixwhatilike.org where they can interact with both of these guests and many more and more in depth. And of course, we will revisit conversations with both of them in the not too distant future. But Fanon wrote that colonialism is not a type of individual relations, but the conquest of a national territory and the oppression of a people. That is all. It is not a certain type of human behavior or a pattern of relations between individuals. Every Frenchman in Algeria is at present time an enemy soldier, end quote. And I think that speaks to the conditions we're describing here. But I know Dr. Haight has one wrap-up question for us all. So, yes, sir, please take it away.
Yeah, I'd just like you to respond to the question of how is Assata Shakur a hero?
For me, I'm with you from Brother Daruba. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Well, Assata Shakur is a hero because Assata Shakur was a City College student at City College in New York. She joined the Black Panther Party. She joined the Black Panther Party at a young age. She was majoring in medical in medicine, and she was starting out there. And she was a typical African woman. Living at that particular time in the 60s, who was conscientized by the struggle of black people in the United States, and she wanted to take her place, or she wanted to contribute to that struggle. So she joined the Harlem chapter of the Black Panther Party. One of the things that she performed, she worked with the health clinic. She He was with our free health clinic program.
Drew, but I'm sorry to rush you, man. We only have a couple minutes, and let's just assume for the sake of this moment that folks got the basic background.
Okay, well,
this question, what makes her a hero? Yeah, please. I'm sorry.
What makes her a hero is that Assata Shakur understood that without the revolutionary response to the armed violence, the police state, that black folks could not maintain any integrity politically or otherwise on any front, reform, radical, or otherwise. So she became a leading advocate of armed self-defense, of armed resistance. In fact, the United States government had an entire program named after her called Chesterog. It was named after her slave name, Chesamard, and it was codenamed Chesterog, Chesamard Robert. Mm. And because they had her as the soul and the spirit of the Black Liberation Army. And as a woman, this was highly unusual. This is something they only did to Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth, to say that she was the soul and the spirit of armed resistance and self-defense for black people. Now, that's very important to understand, that that this was a woman who was thrust into this role and terrified the state by the example that she set. When you compare her example to, say, an Angela Davis, who came out of the left, who came out of the Communist Party USA, who was a child of the Communist Party USA, whose entire struggle was confined to academia and legalism, you can see that there's a significant contrast there. This was a black woman in the historical mold of Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth.
Wow, Frank, could you quickly respond to that in the last couple of minutes, Daruba? Thank you very much.
Yes, I agree with everything Brother Daruba has said. I wanted to say very quickly, I've been teaching Assata's autobiography since 1988, except for the 5 years that I lived in South Africa. I didn't teach it there. I just assumed it would be.
You were living it.
but from 88 to like 91, and then from 96 onward, I've been teaching this book. And what does it do for me? And what does it do for students? What it does, at the University of California, I have a number of black students who come from the inner city, and some of them haven't actually read a complete book from cover to cover. So one thing, they whiz through this book very, very quickly. I mean, this book energizes every time I teach the black protest tradition. This is the book that the evaluations say is the most popular. But the most important thing for me is that I went to college from 1974 to 1978. And if you like the American flag, if you like the police, you didn't have any friends in the black community, okay? Today, what I find is that a lot of students feel shame and uncertain about expressing the antagonism that they feel towards the police and the United States. This is a book that opens up and gives students, young people, permission to talk antagonistically about the world, about the United States, about the police, as opposed to to feel that they must speak apologetically, like some people come to college saying, "I don't hate all police. I just hate what they're doing to me." I can more easily get them out of that mindset and have them tap into what's true to them through reading this particular book. And this book works like for that purpose, like no other book.
Frank Wilderson, Daruba Ben Wahad, that was perfect. Thank you both very much for working with us in this hour. This has been I Mix What I Like here at WPFW 89.3 FM. For Dr. Hate, from Micey and all involved, I'm Jared Ball. We'll catch you in the whirlwind. Like Fred Hampton used to say to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. IMixWhatILike.org for more with these two brothers and much more along with this trajectory of thought. Check us out there, and we'll catch you all in the whirlwind. Thanks again to Frank. Thanks again to Daruba and everybody involved. Peace if you're willing to fight for it. Catch you in the whirlwind. See you next week, everybody.
It's Black Fist Fridays.
Police brutality has never identified our problem. Our problem is one of complete captivity from the birth to death, and coercion as the starting point of our interaction or the response from the state and ordinary white citizens. I mean, we are the world's captive. And so when I was in that all black room and I said I don't hate police brutality, I hate the police, I think that most of the people in that room immediately understood what I was saying.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.